What up, y'all, and happy Monday. I'm so glad you guys are with us. This is a great episode. Number 10, y'all. We've got 10 episodes downloaded so far, and I think it is going awesome. And I hope that you think it's going awesome as well. I'd love for you guys to take this time before we get into the podcast, hit the pause button, go leave us a 5-star review, y'all. Have been killing it with the reviews, and we really do appreciate it. I can't stress that enough, because it helps us out in the algorithm with millions of podcasts out there. This helps people like us find this podcast. So if you can, give us a 5-star review, hit the follow button, and heck, hit the share button and send it to a couple of your friends and tell them you got to listen to this podcast because it is so good. Y'all, this episode is brought to you by bushsurvivaltraining.com. Go to the website, sign up for our $25 survival course. You guys can have that and do it at your leisure in your own home. You don't have to go anywhere or do anything. It's $25. It's an awesome little course for the value. Also, send us an email or you can message us. Let us know how we're doing. And I forgot to tell you, if you do leave us a review, make sure you leave your name and where you're from, because we would love to give you a shout out and give you recognition for giving us that 5-star review. And I also want to, talk about this week's top listening cities, you guys. Y'all have been doing such a great job, and we follow along with all of the statistics for our show. And just to give you a little example, we are listened to in 21 different countries worldwide. And so far there have been 309 different cities across the United States and the world, that are listening to the show. So we want to give thanks to y'all. And, we're going to get into that right now with this week's top listening cities. They have bounced back, everybody. Last week, this wasn't the case. There was one of these in the group, but I'm going to start off with number 5 in our top 5, you guys, with Liberty Hill, Texas, again, making its way into the top 5. We have Chicago, Illinois at number 4. We've got Phoenix, Arizona holding their spot there in number 3. And then we have Portland, Oregon at number 2. And then last but not least, back to number 1, the top listening city for this week is Bend, Oregon. Thank you so much, everybody. And if you want your city to be in the top listening cities, you got to share it with everybody that lives in your neighborhood, y'all. That's the only way you can get there. This episode, I want to warn you, it's maybe for the adults only, okay? We get into some topics here that you might not necessarily want to have that conversation yet with your young ones. So if you have kids, there were a couple of foul words said here. I want to warn you right up front. And we do talk about psilocybin. And, if that's not something you want to explain to your kids, by all means, you guys, towards the end of the episode, it gets a little more kid friendly, but we dive deep here pretty quick into this episode. So I wanted to warn you. And if the little ones are listening, you might want to save this one for whenever it's just adult time. Okay. So without further ado, thank you so much, everybody. And we so appreciate you. Make sure you smash the follow button, give us that 5-star review. And here is episode number 10 with Corey Hawk. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to In the Bush Podcast with Cole and Joel. I am super excited about this episode. This episode actually kind of got
so good to have
Go ahead, Joel.
Go ahead, Cole.
Okay, I was just going to
We're
say
talking
that
over each other as usual.
I know. Well, my internet sucks and I have a bit of a lag, so it is what it is. Everybody, we apologize about that, but yeah, dude, when you said, "Hey, I got Corey coming on Friday." I was like, "Oh, sweet, man." I was super excited. Yeah, I feel like we're just sitting back at freaking boot camp, man.
Yeah. Corey, it's so good to have a friend on the podcast that we can really, talk to a little more openly. I mean, we talk openly anyway, but it's just, that familiarity of having just a friend and a good person joining us is so much fun. This is why we do this, right? This is why we do this podcast. We want to have fun and we want to learn and be inspired, but having fun is a prerequisite. So today we have Corey Hawk, who was actually joined. It was myself, Cole, and Corey. We all met together at Alone Season 7 Boot Camp, and then myself and Corey went on to participate in Season 7 of Alone. He has also done the Ultimate Marksman. Hey, Corey, is that right? That's the show you competed in with archery.
Yes, yeah,
Okay.
the History Channel's Ultimate Marksman.
Yeah, so we'll talk a little bit more about that, and then of course you run the company Organic Archer. Which you're a Boyer, and who, those of you that don't know what that is, he builds bows for a living, and you can purchase them, but also you have transitioned into teaching bow building. So you are a wonderful guest for us to have on to really dig in a little bit into primitive archery, as well as just catching up in regarding life. It's been a while, so welcome to the show, man. It's so good to have you here.
Thanks, guys. I'm excited to be here. I'm glad you had me on and
Yeah, I think back on. Hey, Corey, are you still there?
yeah, I lost him. That's
Oh, we
funny.
lost
It's okay. He might
him.
have skipped out on just on the his internet or
Looked
something.
like
So
it looked like he touched. It looked like he touched something, and then we lost him.
yeah,
So,
it's all right. We'll just keep rolling a little bit.
yeah.
So yeah,
Yeah, give him a minute.
Corey builds some amazing bows, and I've actually had the
Guys, you got me.
opportunity. Yeah, I got you back. I can hear you. Can't see you yet.
There we go. There we go. Yeah.
I forgot to turn on Do Not Disturb, and I had a call come in.
Oh yeah.
It totally kicked me out of the meeting, but I can just start from scratch if you guys want that.
Well, Corey, I mean, yeah, why don't you, for those of you that don't know you, why don't you just give a quick introduction of, I'd love you just to talk about organic archery and your company. And sort of your background and how what inspired you to get to start up Organic Archery?
So organic archery has been a thing since 2018. I started out just building bows as sort of a all-encompassing sort of passionate hobby that really took a hold of me after I got back from the military. I had returned home. It was a pretty stressful time, multiple combat deployments in the Middle East, and I was just looking for sort of a therapeutic or artistic release of some of that energy. And I have always been a bow hunter, lifelong family of bow hunters and outdoorsmen. And I decided I would pick up a bow. So I bought a traditional bow online, just a fiberglass Samick Sage was what they were at the time.
Yep,
I
the old
think,
Samick Sage.
a very well-known bow. I think they've changed names several times since then, but started shooting that and I was shooting it every day and I was loving it. And, was breaking a lot of arrows, so I figured I would learn how to make my own arrows to save money. So I started with arrow making, which most people don't know is a totally separate craft. In
Absolutely.
fact, many times throughout history, you have the hunter-gatherers who make all of their own equipment, but when you were talking about military style archery and mass quantities of things, you would have your professional bowyers and you would have your professional fletchers, and they work together. So you would have to go get your bow from one guy and your arrows from the other. But nowadays, every bowyer is expected to be a fletcher as well. So I actually started on arrows and worked with those for quite some time before I felt a little bit weird shooting these primitive wooden arrows out of a store-bought bow. So I wanted to learn how to make bows. Bought every book I could find. Watched probably 100 hours of YouTube videos. Anything I could digest on YouTube, I would watch over and over. And then I just dove in. built as a hobby for 6 years before starting organic archery. And I went full time in 2018. And then it was probably about 4 years ago. So around 2020 timeframe, we decided that it would be a lot of fun to teach this to other people. So I started to I moved very slowly into the class setting. I think that first year we opened up, I don't know, half a dozen classes, maybe real small ones. And they went well. You know, we didn't sell them all. It was fairly new at the time. But the people that did show up had a great time. And so the word kind of got out and we expanded. And now the bow making school is actually my primary endeavor. And so I've tried to pull away from custom orders a little bit. I still make tons of bows. I'm building on YouTube and giving everything away that I make on YouTube. But the teaching is my big thing right now, and it's been the best decision I've ever made. So we love the school, and my wife really enjoys it, and we love meeting
Oh
all the
man.
people.
There's well, so first off, before ask some questions, I just wanted to congratulate you because we haven't talked a lot in the last couple of years, but you have got married and you've had your first kid, right?
Yes, I have a 6-month-old son.
That's,
That's
I
awesome.
mean, how is that? I mean, I know it's life changing, it's amazing, but how has that as a man, like, what have you felt change in you?
I felt the biggest change for me was, and I forget who I heard this from, but it just stuck with me and it rung so true. It was that I don't want to be a businessman with a family. I want to be a family man with a business. And so there was a big shift there. I would say that the steepest learning curve for me is figuring out how to balance work. So I'm trying to be in here a lot less. Hard cutoff times in the evenings to spend time with my family and do other things that we need to do, you know, in our little homestead. But I would say the first, you know, 3 months or so, he really didn't have much of a use for me.
No, the beginning part sucks. Let's be honest.
But now that he's 6 months old, he's just about to start to crawl. He's like climbing all over stuff, and he's so interested in the outside world. Nothing makes him happier than being outside. I recently got this awesome baby carrying backpack now that he can hold himself up. So he sits on top of me, kind of like I'm like the elephant, you know, and he's like steering. So we're outside all the time in that pack, and he'll hang out with me when I'm shooting my bow and doing yard work and stuff. So it's been great.
Dude,
Heck
it's
yeah.
incredible. There's just no words for it. I mean, Cole, can you even remember when that happened? I mean, you got
Dude,
a
it's
your
been a
boy's
long
eight,
time. Yeah.
19?
Yeah, my son's 19. He moved out and graduated a couple years ago. My daughter is she'll be 17 in March, so she's going to be a senior next year. She's finishing up her junior year right now. Yeah, man, I remember those times. I actually just shared a picture on Facebook a few days ago that with Madison laying next to me. It was a picture I had actually shared, but she was little bitty, man. I'm like, holy crap, dude. Like, I'm fixing to be kidless, and Corey, you're just now jumping into this stuff. It's awesome.
I'm like in the middle.
You're,
I'm a
yeah,
little
you're
late
right in
to
the
the
game
middle.
here.
You know what though, man? It's so enriching. And you know, the one thing, like, Talon will be turning 7 next week. The beautiful thing about, I think, well, I can't really talk to having a girl because I've only got a boy. But the beautiful thing to having a boy is you really can relive your childhood. Like, everything happens vicariously, but because it's your flesh and blood, it feels like you're doing it. And then it transitions from, like, instead of you doing it, you actually have more fun doing it with your son. Like, you get more pleasure out of watching him do things, especially for the first time, like the first time, like, he throws a spark off a ferro rod, or the first time he, like, shoots his bow and it hits, like, the target. Like, the reaction in his body is just priceless. So I'm excited for you to start experiencing these things in the near future, man. It's awesome.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to him. He really wants to be mobile so badly. I can tell he's an adventurous little spirit. So my wife is terrified of it. You know, she wants him to be a little in arms baby the whole time. But I'm like, come on, let's get mobile, man. Let's go on some adventures.
Start getting him prepped for the hunt.
That's so awesome.
So, man, where do we start? Well, first of all, You know, when we were at orientation camp for season seven, I just think back so fondly on that because we had, you know, apart from all the filming and like the training and stuff that we had to do at orientation camp, we had that free time to just go and do what we wanted. And I remember there was a couple times that you and I together just walked off and we went shed hunting for I think we found a bunch of moose. We might even found a few caribou sheds, but we were just like you couldn't call it really stump shooting. We were moss shooting. We're just shooting into the boggy ground. But you know, like I really felt like we had really some good bonding. Like we just shooting arrows together and walking around looking for sheds. It was just spectacular. And you were sharing knowledge. And you know, there's something that you shared with the group, which I honestly have never forgot. I've used it now religiously. You said, "Hey guys, just a quick little tip. If you're out there and it's wet and your fletchings flatten on the arrows, just boil some water in your pot and just put the arrow over the steam. And so the fletchings will actually fluff back out. And if you just work them, you'll just get them back right back to where they should be." And since then, that is the technique I've used several times. Such a small, cool little technique that I didn't know about, and it works great. And especially when I hunt blacktail here on the coast, I mean, every single day is just, you know, hunting in rain. So I use that just about every day to get their fletchings all puffed back out. So thank you for that.
That's awesome. It works like a charm. I'm glad it's been
It works
helpful.
like a charm.
It does,
Yeah,
and
that was such a cool.
I learned that from Joel, that learned it from you, and me and Keith actually used it in Oklahoma this year while whitetail hunting, which was
There we go.
yeah,
Nice.
man. So we're just
There we
spreading it
go.
all about. That's
Yeah.
great. That's
Bro,
people need to know. It's an important
how is
tip.
your knee? Like I gotta ask, how is your, so for those that are listening and haven't seen Alone season seven, Corey had to leave because of his knee to a really bad knee injury, which plagued you for years afterwards. And I'm wondering, has that fully recovered? Did you have surgery? What's the status with that?
It took 2 full years to recover.
Damn.
And I still am working on mindful exercises and mindful rehabilitation because they really don't recommend surgery for people my age anymore. They're kind of reserving that more for elderly people or, you know, just people who are generally unwell. But for a fit, healthy young person, they're really not doing surgery. So they advise me to do at least 1 to 2 years of PT, which I did. And that helped, but there's still some just nagging issues, you know, like every once in a while it feels full of fluid and whatnot, but it's very manageable. I would say I'm back up to like at least 90% other than the odd aches and pains. And
Sure.
so long as I do my part not to, you know, I don't do like heavy loaded back squats or anything like that
Okay.
anymore.
Okay.
So I've modified my training to be a little bit more, normal, or I guess let's call it a little bit more functional. I
More
don't really
functional,
lift
yeah.
super heavy anymore. I'm a lot more into yeah, the primal type fitness, functional movement, animalistic type movement, stretching,
Yeah.
running, sprinting, things like that. Climbing trees, obviously I love to climb trees because I hunt,
Yeah.
and the trees around here can be quite difficult to climb, so that's a great workout. But yeah, just trying to keep it more functional. I really don't see, as I get older, any reason to keep loading up these barbells with tons of weight. Really, it just ends up leading to injury or exaggerating injuries that you already
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's probably smart. Man, that was so unfortunate. I mean, it's funny because alone when I think about it now, there's certain things that feel like there was very impactful things that'll never leave me, that'll always feel like they were yesterday. But a lot of the experience is somewhat of a blur, you know, because it's been a little while. But do you feel like there's things that still kind of come up from that experience that, you know, whether it be good or bad?
I don't really think so. I definitely struggled with, you know, the guilt of failure and just letting myself down, feeling like I let my family down after, you know, having to quit so early. But I suppose I wrestled with it for some time after, but now that it's been years, I'm just on to the next thing. There's
Yeah.
no point in ruminating for forever, you know.
No.
I took some really very valuable lessons away from that.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a blessing in disguise in my mind because, you know, you've got people that stay out there 40, 50, 70, 80 days, like really long stays, and it can create some long-term complications that not a lot of people talk about, or maybe they do, and I just don't hear it. But I mean, mineral deficiencies,
Yeah.
sleep issues, appetite issues, gut microbiome issues. So it really was a blessing in disguise.
Yeah, sleep issues, man. That was what plagued me, and mineral deficiency. Those two were the biggest killers. And you know, Cole did the Naked and Afraid like a year ago or something, and he also just had the hardest time with sleep issues. It's like something that doesn't get talked about much, but trying to sleep out there is so difficult. And I really haven't nailed down why, but I feel like, I mean, one theory I have is that I was eating predominantly the lake trout, which were very fatty, full of oils. So I have to wonder if that those sort of fish oils stimulated my brain in a way that I just couldn't shut it off, because I felt like I was just absolutely surging with creativity 24/7. I literally could not turn that switch off.
Yeah.
Like, Cole, what do you think it was just the discomfort of the ground, or why would you say you had a
Mine
hard time
was
with your sleep?
definitely a combo of the dis, you know, being bare ass to the ground, you know, in the sand and whatever else I was laying on. But I agree, man, 'cause I never got to a point where I really felt like I was super hungry or starving or anything like that. So it wasn't like I was hunger pains or anything. It was more of I either couldn't shut it down or I would just if I fell asleep, it would be for 5 minutes and then I'd be burning so hot on one side from facing the fire, I'd have to flip over. And it was just rotisserie chicken. So it was just something that you could fall asleep if you could get to sleep fast enough. But then, you know, we had scars whenever we came out of there, man, from the fire, from sitting too close to the fire on my back and on my sides. So I think. But at the same time, it was the same way. I was just all in my mind the whole time, because we got locked in the Boma. I couldn't just go walk out and roam, you know. So it was, I just sat there like I
And it's
was
kind of like
getting trapped in my room.
you have so much responsibility out there, like especially in that beginning. Hey, Corey, like when you first get dropped off out there, you're in a brand new location. Excuse me, you've never set foot there. And in your head, I mean, what was going through your head when you got dropped off?
I talked about it a lot on camera, but you know, they're very limited with their editing. They really try to just paint a general story of your experience, but it's not exactly like what you experienced. So I got dropped. My first thought was nothing but exploration for the rest of this day and all day tomorrow. And so I had this big, especially while I was fresh, had this big mountain in my backyard. My terrain was like very steep on all sides. There was nowhere that you could walk that wasn't steep. And so I headed up to the very top and I scouted and I saw that I had a remote pond in there. So I was like, well, I'm going to go down in there and scout the whole pond. Let's find the best place. You know, maybe the lake's not the best place for my shelter. Maybe there's a real sweet spot down by the pond. So I spent all day scouting the pond area. It turns out it was just a big marsh, really nowhere that wasn't basically underwater to set up shelter. So ended up coming all the way back to almost exactly where the helicopter
Where they
dropped me.
dropped you.
Yeah. And so then I'm thinking, I was maybe 200 yards away from where they dropped me. So of course, and you're thinking, oh, you idiot, you know, you wasted 2 days. You should have just like saved that energy. But then I was telling the camera, like, I'm not doing anything else until this shelter is built. Because that was such a huge responsibility in my mind, was just getting at least a warm and cozy shelter. Because I had figured, you know, what, 2, 3 weeks we'd be in the snow. And the nights were already getting chilly. So really dive deep into the shelter, which is where I got injured. And I didn't really feel like particularly rushed or anything. You know, it was more just like a chug, like a slog through deep mud, you know, to like get the shelter built for however many days it took. I think probably until day 7 or so. But then after that, I'm like, okay, food. And of course, the show is like, Corey, I haven't eaten any food in
I
7
know.
days. You know, it's like, well, yeah, because I've been telling you guys, I'm not going to eat any food until this is done. So then it was build gill nets, run the trap line, start bow hunting to and from every location all the time. Built this cool little handreel fishing kit with like 6 different colored lures made out of brass and silver trapping wire, and was fishing all day to no avail. But then put out the gill nets and started catching fish. But yeah, then and by then I'm just like monitoring the injury,
Yeah.
which happened on probably day four. By like day seven, I'm like, oh crap, stop building the shelter. Starting to feel this injury come on. By day nine, I'm getting a lot of swelling. By like day 10, loss of stability. And I'm just one more daying it at a time by then. But and then so then you add injury onto all the responsibilities you already have, because it seems like you'd just be able to just kick back and like enjoy nature, but there's so much stuff that has to be done. And everything takes forever. It takes like, I feel like it takes an hour just to get going in the morning. You got to get water in you. You got to get dressed, and you're moving slow. And there's all this stuff that needs to be done. You got to get your camera set up. And then there's the added thing of the cameras. That's a huge responsibility. Yeah, it's a mental burden for sure. I would say the mental aspect of just the whole thing and juggling it all is a huge part of it.
Yeah,
I
it
think,
really is. And that responsibility never dies down.
yeah, I think a lot of people don't really understand that whenever they're looking through their TV at that. Because, like, the amount of firewood alone that you would have to gather, and we were only getting down into the 40s, granted I was naked, but when you gather 2 nights of firewood, and then that night you and your partner burn those 2 nights of firewood, then you got to go back the next day and go get more firewood. And increasingly, I told Shell, I was like, hey, let's go as far as we can to get firewood, and then every day we'll just get firewood closer and closer to camp as our bodies diminish, And a lot of people don't think about that kind of stuff. And then you add a friggin' knee injury, and like, if you're having to drag firewood for 400 yards, that ain't no joke, man. Let alone all the other stuff that you have to do.
Reminiscing about all of this always makes me think of something. You and I, we talked about our sort of profound experiences, working with psilocybin and how the changes are just have been so like life changing and so like profound in certain areas. And you told me about one of your experiences, which was just incredible. Like I couldn't believe how vivid it sounded and that you could actually hear voices. Like I've had definitely had hallucinatory experiences for sure with working with psilocybin, but not to the extent it sounded like you've had. And I've done some big deep ceremonies. I think I've done 5.5 grams is one of the biggest doses I've taken. But I personally, I know we share that all three of us share that, right? Psilocybin is definitely funny enough. I'll say it very cliche. It brought me to God. I mean, it really did. It turned me into a spiritual being, and it completely changed my life. And I realized the missing link with my spirituality. Even though, ever since I was a kid, I always felt like there was something out there. But it was psilocybin that really I needed in order to seal my belief system and to really learn a lot about myself. And I'd love to ask you about if you're willing to share like how psilocybin has ch sort of changed, like influenced you in life, because I know it's been profound.
Yeah, this is a deep question. Tough to answer because I've been doing, I believe it was Terrence McKenna possibly, who came up with the idea of extremely large doses extremely infrequently. So that's what I do. It takes a lot of time to muster up the courage to take a journey like that. It takes a lot out of you. It's very trying. You will experience the ego death, or maybe ideas that will change your life forever. And once you've seen them, you can't unsee them. It's kind of like, in my experience, the fruit of the tree of knowledge. Once you have eaten it, you can't unsee that other side. And so, I mean, I don't even know where to start, because my entire life would be, I can't even picture what it would look like without psilocybin. And because of the influences that it's had on my spirituality, my connection to God, my connection to the earth, my business decisions, a lot of them have been influenced by psilocybin.
When you say influenced, have you had specific visions which you know to be something you need to follow, and you have actually followed them?
Or is it more of like a download and you come out of the experience just with this knowledge? Because I think there's so many different ways that you experience it, because man, sometimes it's even like a week after and I'm like, oh my gosh, like there that was something that I remembered from the experience. And yeah, so it's, you know, because so I want to preface this because not a lot of our listeners are very well versed on psilocybin. Okay. I have a lot of family that probably listens to this, and I grew up in the church and I grew up, you know, the Bible and this and that. And I don't want to get into all the religion and everything, but I was at a point in my life to where it was the same way, where I was kind of like, okay, what's really going on here? And I did the, you know, what you would say, Terrence McKenna's, what does he call it? A whatever dosed,
The heroic
heroic,
dose,
the
I think
heroic
is.
dose. Yeah. And I took like 7 grams at that time. And I felt like I was taken out of my body and sat on the hand of God and was shown, yes, I am real. Yes, there is a creator. This is all of us are connected, and here's how we are connected. And it, you know, it like showed me all these things without it being some. People get the idea that there's just these, you know, you're seeing these visions, and sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes it's more like you get a download, right? And
Yeah,
you
like an
don't,
energetic download.
yeah. And so I just want to, you know, kind of preface that to these, this is profound medicine, is what I want to say. Okay. And a lot of people don't understand that. And there's a lot of bias about this plant medicine. And I want it to be known that this is something that I think every single person in the world needs to participate in, whether that be in a very micro way or in a macro way, to depending on the experience that you're wanting to have. So
Yeah, and
I don't mean to
sure.
interrupt
You know
that,
what though?
Corey. Yeah, I just wanted to,
Yeah, and Cole,
because
I just.
I just want people to understand that we've been fed a bunch of bullshit about what psilocybin really is. And it is like, I don't do doctors, I don't do medicine, I don't do any of that. I do all natural, you know, for the most part. If I have a headache, maybe I might take ibuprofen, but I highly doubt it. You know what I mean? But for my psyche, like psilocybin has taken me and shown me so much that, man, I wish I would have been taking it like way back and understood that it wasn't some little party drug or something. Like, this is something that could severely help you in a bad way of your life. I want people to understand that.
Yeah, it could, but you know, also just to kind of add on to that, Cole, I don't think it is for everyone. I don't think everyone should take it. I feel like you have this inner urge, this inner just energetic pull towards something, whether that's like playing soccer or whatever. Like, as you walk through life, you have energetic pulls to do certain things, and for whatever reason, it doesn't matter. But point is that once you follow that pull, you end up finding a passion for something. And if you have that energetic pull to work with plant medicine, you absolutely should respect that calling and you should go for it. But circling back to what Corey said, it is scary. It's very intimidating when you're prepping for a big heroic dose. It is not to be taken lightly because once you get shown things, you cannot unsee them. And unfortunately, well, I'll say, fortunately slash unfortunately, depends on which way you look at it, you're going to get shown a whole bunch of shit about yourself that you might not like to see. But the beauty of it is you see it in a way that you can completely comprehend at a cellular level. So you know that the ball has been put in your court. And you know what you've been seen, and most of the time you'll know what you need to do, but the trick is really going and doing it. And I always say that the ceremony is kind of the easy part. The hard part is actually the after effects of going back out into life and integrating and making those changes, you know. And I feel like that is the true medicine right there, is being able to accept the flaws that are shown to you and then being able to try and walk through life and change them. So, you know, like Corey, like with your experiences, what do you think you've changed about yourself?
Well, let me first say I definitely agree with you, Joel. And Cole, I think there is, when you have these profound experiences, you want to share it with everybody. You're like, man, that was so life-changing. That was so great. I wish everyone could experience this profound peace that I have, this profound love for humanity and the planet. And so you want to share that. But I agree with Joel that there's just this weird pull and you can't really describe it. I had first heard about psilocybin mushrooms. Joe Rogan had mentioned it in passing on some podcast years ago. I was like, oh, that's interesting. I've never heard it spoke about in that way before. I thought it was just a party drug, you know? And then I probably researched, I mean, really deep dived into psilocybin research and reading people's journey reports and things like that all through the internet forums for 2 full years before I could screw up the courage enough. Because I had decided at that time, you know, that the hero's dose is what I want to do. Yeah. I'm not interested in, you know, colorful fractals, and I want a profound life-changing experience. And so, yeah, like my first experience, for example, I was like, okay, let's start small, you know, let's go 3.5 grams and just ride it out for a little while. And it was a beautiful night, you know, lightning bugs everywhere, and just middle of June, like beautiful weather. All the night creatures were out, most picturesque experience you can imagine. I'm in the forest, and I'm like, several hours go by. I'm like, okay, this is beautiful. You know, I'm getting some downloads. I'm understanding the connection between me and the forest. You know, I'm seeing some images of me like melting into the trees and stuff like that. But then I'm like, this is great. This is beautiful. I'm understanding. I like this, but it's not quite what I was looking for. And so maybe an hour later, I took 3.5 more grams to make it 7. And then it was like, this audible voice told me, you should probably go sit down. And I just, so I walked and I sparked up a fire real quick in my fire pit, and I sat down, and it was gone from there. I've experimented with everything from, my first ever was 7. I don't think there's, and I've only done this, you know, a short number of times over the years. I probably can only maybe muster up the courage twice a year. If that, maybe once a year sometimes, because these downloads take a long time to unpack and to integrate and to kind of get in, like ingrained into your life before you feel called to do it again. Well said. But everywhere from 7 to 12 grams at a time. But I will say that for me, 10 grams is like the threshold, because from that point, especially during the peak hour or so, on really big doses above like 10, I lose sight of reality. I get stuck in loops, and they're not really helpful to me. They're cool and everything, and they're you know, informative in their own way. But like, for example, I've been stuck in a water loop where like I became water, and I'm like spiraling, kind of like as a toilet's flushing, you know, and I'm like moving through all these different, I'm moving through the trees and the ocean and the fish and every living person as water. And it was really intense and really uncomfortable. And that lasted for a good number of hours. And then I got stuck in another loop once where same thing, I'm spiraling. I see a lot of spirals and a lot of yin-yangs and connecting everything throughout human history. And I was spiraling through like tree roots and eternity as the plants. And I got stuck in there for some time. So I've decided that I don't really like those spiraling loops. And so I limit it to about 10 grams, but everything from, I mean, it strengthened my faith in God. I was kind of wishy-washy, you know, like, maybe I could be convinced. I'm definitely a Christian, but, I don't know, I have some questions. And after my work with mushrooms, no one will ever tell me that there is not a creator. No one will ever tell me that we are not God, that this is not all made by God. I've heard audible voices from someone who's described themselves as the God of Abraham, who has led me through different challenges in my life. given me key pointers of how to get past obstacles in business or my marriage or my family. It's healed a lot of family wounds for me. Just old stuff, like tough love, father wounds, money wounds, these things that you hold that you don't even realize. Like one big lesson I took away was, I grew up in this world where money doesn't grow on trees. You know what I mean? We work hard for money. Money's hard to make. You fucking get up and you do it. Yeah. And it made me realize, like, first of all, money is not real. It's baloney, but we've agreed that it's a legal form of tender, So, and we've used it to extort and, extort the entire planet, but that's besides the point. But it just made me realize that money is easy to make. All I have to do is find something that I'm called to, which in my example is bows and arrows. And that calling is going to be different for everybody. Maybe you're called to do sustainable farming. Maybe you're called to do carpentry. Maybe you're called to be the best block mason you could ever be. I don't know what it's going to be. Maybe you're called to be an instructor of some kind, a fitness instructor, a health coach. You have to give all of yourself every time. And it will manifest the money. Like and it's just made me sort of realize that money is easy to make if I, if I reframe my mind and if I'm actually putting genuine effort into it, like my whole heart, the money comes as a byproduct of providing something that you've given your whole heart to that's adding value to other people's lives. So that was a big one. I have discovered that because I ask a lot of questions, I'm trying to figure stuff out when I'm in that place, so
yeah, me too.
I'm like, what is this, are we on a flat earth? Are we on a ball spinning through space? Like, are we in a simulation? What is this? And it won't give me complete answers. It speaks in riddles sometimes and leaves me guessing. But one thing I have figured out is that it is a choose your own adventure creation machine. And I am a piece of God. God has bestowed upon humanity the gift of creation. The hands are very important. Our five fingers and our opposable thumbs. It's a gift from the divine. And we are creators, just like our creator. And you choose your own adventure. You can make it whatever you want. And everything changes everything. So you have a responsibility. And I feel like this is what the Bible is trying to teach people. You have a responsibility with every single decision you make throughout the day. It's what you eat. It's what you say. It's what you consume through the media. And I'm not perfect by any means. I have my vices. I have my three-dimensional problems. You know what I mean? I got bills to pay. We got shit that comes up. Car transmission goes out. I don't know. Figured out. We all have three-dimensional problems that we have to face on this earth. But you also have a responsibility through everything you consume, be it food, media, your relationships, who you surround yourself with, to create heaven or hell on earth in this time that you have here. And that's a realization that I've had, like, oh yeah, and every decision that you make that's a positive one, whether it's, to eat the donut or to eat the steak, that's a decision. The steak's going to take your body and your mind a little bit closer to heaven on earth. And it's hard to describe, and you guys know this, but it's kind of like every little decision you make means everything, but at the end, it kind of nothing really means anything at all.
Well, I think it's
so hard to describe.
It really teaches us to be mindful, and like my big download was, all of this really boils down to love, like all of it, no matter what. Like at the end of the day, when you're laying on your deathbed, you just want to make sure that you are loved and the people that you surrounded yourself with and your family knew that you loved them, period. That's really the end of it.
And you put love into your work, and you put love into your, like you guys' podcast, you're putting love into that. I mean, it's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple things which I really think about all the time when I sum up a lot of my experiences. And that is, it is my duty to show up as a real, authentic human being, to express my insecurities, to accept them, but also to accept my achievements and not take myself too seriously. And just remember that everyone else is going through the same thing. Everyone else is going through the same thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't need to beat myself up about a lot of things. And I don't need to hide a lot of things. I think showing up in an honest way, you know, a good example would be, I mean, a great example would be the old school male, right? That you don't talk about your feelings. You don't cry. You know, so my stepfather raised me that way. You don't cry. I don't show, you know, you're a wussy if you do that. Well, those men, so-called men, are hiding behind those emotions that they're feeling just like every other man. But they put on this tough facade because that's what men do. And boy, were they wrong. And that yeah. is something that I'm so certain of to the core of my being. No, yeah. a real man will cry with the joy or the, you know, or the love of their children, of their wife. They will express their emotions outwards, but they will also be able to turn around and go and fight a battle. You know yes. what I mean? They can show up in the way that they need to show up depending on the situation. You know, I kiss my son. You know, I kiss him. I kiss him because I love him, and I just, you know, I'm affectionate with him. But at the same time, I can also go and I can, you know, shed blood if I need to protect him, you know, and that's being a real man. And when I say that's being, I'm not saying I'm a real man. I aspire to be a real man, a man that is in touch with his strengths and with his weaknesses and not ashamed of his strengths and weaknesses, because we're not created the same. We all have those differences, and that's fine. That's fine. Enjoy and celebrate what it is that you've got that's a blessing, and just accept what you've got that is not considered a blessing. Everyone's going through the same thing, you know?
And yeah. That's one of the gifts we have as men. It's just this switch to turn it off. To you have to be able to bear your cross, to go into battle, to make business decisions. But it's just a switch. It's just a switch.
It's just a switch, and you've got to know how to turn that switch on and off at the right time.
Yeah.
And it's a hard line to walk, you know. And then there's also, I think, the second thing I wanted to mention was the trust that I've built up in following my heart. Heart or intuition, gut feel, however you want to phrase it, just trusting in that. And that I felt has never led me astray. If I use that as my compass, as you say, if I use that as my compass, the money will come when I'm looking at business. You know, if I use that as my compass in choosing friends, the fulfillment of having good companionship will come. You know, if I use it as my compass to pursue certain hobbies, then the fulfillment and pleasure of those hobbies will come. Everything aligns. But when you get too caught up in your head and you ignore your heart, that's where the confliction happens. And I feel like that creates more trouble and confusion. So those are the two things that I really have had a lot of, I guess, mentorship from our creator on. And, you know, we all get our medicine in a way that we need it. And I feel like it is just an ancient rite of ours to be working with these medicines. It's just incredible that it's become taboo and illegal. I mean, these indigenous used all sorts of different type of plant medicines in the same way, whether it was connecting with their ancestors and receiving teachings or getting, you know, guidance from the animal spirits. Like, how there's so many variations of how indigenous used type medicines like this to enhance themselves and their lives and their interactions with each other. So I don't think it's anything that we need to be ashamed about. I think it's something that needs to be spoken about. So Corey, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Thanks for opening up that conversation. I really don't talk about it very often, except, you know, maybe in my inner circle, but that's just something that I suppose is still somewhat considered taboo. It's definitely coming into the limelight.
Yeah.
I do agree with you that these plant medicines, have a very unique way of presenting the lessons to you in a way that is perfect for you. Just because, say, the God of Abraham leads me through these mystical adventures doesn't mean that you won't have an experience with an animal. Or I've heard people having experience with an elderly woman who describes herself as Mother Earth. I've had experiences with an owl as a spirit guide out in the forest, where there was an owl right over the top of me, and he was sort of teaching me these things. And so,
man, that's crazy.
I think it has a really weird way of coming to you in exactly the way that you need it, through the messenger that you need at that time. Mm. It's always going to look different. Like, one of the problems that I ran into was trying to recreate the same experience.
Yeah, me too.
It's very, very important that you just surrender, because if you try to push your will onto these medicines or beings that are far more powerful than you, they're going to win every time. So yeah, surrender is really important, and just melting into whatever the lesson is for you at that time. And like you said, one of you guys touched on this earlier, it might not be what you want. It might not be what you had envisioned for that journey. It might be really challenging lessons that flip your whole world upside down, or cause you to cry like you've never cried before, or to mourn like you've never mourned before. You got to be prepared for the tough ones too. But that you come out on the other side a little bit shaken up, but a much better person, regardless of whether it's difficult or pleasant or euphoric or whatever your experience ends up being, mystical.
Yeah. Well said, man. I hope you guys would agree, but I feel it's just absolutely like liberating to be able to talk this way among brothers, you know. And I really do use that term in the term of the biblical sense, you know. I look at you two as brothers, like people that I would put my life on the line for, that, you know, because I know the essence of what you two are made of. And I think that's really important, more important than any of this medicine stuff. The medicine stuff opens you up to be able to see things that way. But we are all here, as Cole says, to love each other and look out for each other. And if this community grows throughout the world, can you imagine what the world would be and how we interact with nature? It would be incredible. So
that's why we're
I
here,
really
dude.
I struggle with that. I definitely get the Spirit Brothers thing. I've got a lot of lessons about Spirit Brothers. It's you guys, just our sort of group that's forming, with people who are coming back to the family, coming back to the land, like this movement that we're seeing. But I do have some hard lessons from time to time, because like Cole, I want everyone to experience it. But I've been told before that it can't be that way. That there has to be a separation, and it's unfortunate because everyone wants unity. Everybody wants equality. But the in my experience, in my lessons, that's just not reality. There are souls on this earth that are younger souls and older souls, maybe people, and this, take this with a grain of salt. I'm just spitballing here. This is anecdotal at best.
Love it.
I'm not saying it's true. I'm not saying it's the way it is, but the way that I see it is, there are people that have experienced many different lifetimes and had a lot of time to grow. I feel like this time around, I'm one of those people. And the weird thing is, this doesn't make me a non-Christian, because I believe in past lives, because I've seen my own past lives through psilocybin, and my past lives drew me to archery. I've seen myself like laying on the battlefield in many different times throughout periods of history, filled full of arrows, just dead on the battlefield. So I've always been drawn to archery. I feel like I was a warrior in this life as a United States Marine and so forth. I've been a warrior in past lives as well. So that's what's calling to me this time around. But I feel like I'm recognizing that. I'm seeing some of maybe the mistakes I've made previously, or I'm just remembering certain things. But there are souls out there that are not that far along. And I think the Bible does a good description of describing how there will always be the poor among you, and there are always going to be the sinners and the evildoers, and those people have their own lessons to learn, but not everyone's going to be able to ascend into a next plane of thinking. I feel in my intuition feels like there's probably going to be a separation, because I feel it happening. And I've heard from other people that they feel it as well, where say half or a certain group of people are just going to go over here and try to bring back what we've lost. And the other people are just going to be blissfully unaware in the metaverse or the matrix or whatever sort of utopian, dystopian fantasy world they create over here, that they're going to go live in, you know, gluttony and sloth and promiscuity and things like that. And there will be a separation. And I think it will become more and more clear that you are one or the other. And it will become so obvious that you won't even be able to associate with those people anymore. Like, you'll feel the vibration of those people the moment you encounter them and be like, we can be friendly. Like, I feel compassion for you, but this conversation is where our relationship ends.
Yeah.
Like, you go do you, I'm going to go do me. I'm going to do me with my people over here that are, you know, seeing the bigger picture. And you just go back to whatever it is, Amazon.
I
mean, you can
Amazon
feel
shopping, and you know,
you can feel that right now. I mean, you can definitely distinguish that within minutes of meeting somebody today. I feel like, I mean, I can definitely, you know, remember some people that I've met that I'm like, oh man, I can just feel something, you know, not have a good interaction and everything, but you can just feel it deep down. Like, this person, I don't feel good being around them. You know?
Yeah. There's that sixth sense that we've lost, that energetic sense that I feel like working with plant medicine. And as you sort of get deeper into the understanding of how to go about navigating this world, that sense starts to enhance more and more, to the point that you just meet a person within a few minutes. I mean, energetically, that sense is telling you very clearly whether this is someone you're attracted to or not. And it's like, the stronger the sense gets, it's easier to read. It's just easier to navigate life very, very easily, because it's just that instinctual, like, intuitive feeling, knowing on whether this is something to pursue or not. And Corey, your whole description there of where you think things are headed, 100%. I can absolutely resonate with every single word you're saying. And it's hard to describe. I think you did a much better job than I could, but I feel the same way. I feel that there is a separation, and it hurts my heart, because I hope I'm on the good side of that. I'd like to think my life is going in that direction, but I'm not 100% certain, but I feel like it. But I also feel so much pain for the people that are not on that path. You know, like, I hate to bring up COVID, but there was such an example with COVID of, like, one way or the other. You know, you're either driven by complete fear, overwhelmed by fear, or you were sort of oblivious to it, and life didn't change all that much. But right. The people that were overwhelmed with fear, life was terrible through that stage. And that was an example to me of how different we can be in really the same place in life, but just such different experiences.
I feel compassion too, because you want to bring everyone with you, but this is a manipulation by fear. This has been going on for many, many thousands of years. I mean, I think people get really caught. I see a lot of pain in people who want to solve issues that are so much bigger than them. We have so many injustices in this world that are being activated for us, mistreatment, you name it. It goes on and on. Corrupt governments, out of control taxes, pick your poison. It doesn't matter. But there's a huge demographic of people that think that if they just ride in the streets long enough, or if they vote hard enough, that it's going to change. And so I think I think the main shift between the two people are those that realize that the only things that are within their control are in their inner circle. It's my only responsibility. The only way that I can actually affect the whole is by squaring away my life, like fixing
Yep.
the
Yep.
fixing like maintaining a peaceful, productive work environment right here, maintaining a peaceful, productive family and a loving family environment right here in my home. I can't fix all the children that are being abused and just like on and on and on. It's so much bigger than me. And it makes me feel guilt, but at this point in my life, I just can't be bothered with it. Like, I don't give a shit who is running for president. I don't give a shit what the news says. I don't care about pandemics. Call me naive, call me whatever, but my responsibility lies right here in my inner circle, to love my family, to love my friends, to surround myself with people who feel the same way. And through that, it's going to ripple. My son will take those values and he'll pass those on to his. And within, like, I don't know, 3, 4 generations, it's hundreds of people that have been affected.
Well,
Millions, maybe
think
even.
about your bow building classes too. You know, I'm sure that every individual that's coming into that space is leaving slightly touched by you and, you know, just your energetic output. Because I agree that you, with what you're saying, where you just control what is controllable. And what you can control is the people in your immediate surroundings is to show up in a way of being authentic and truthful, of being that man that we're talking about. And when you do, those people feel that. They feel it and they're drawn towards it. It makes them think about themselves and get a little introspective. And they might walk away changing their life just from being, just from feeding off of your light that you put off. And that's what you can control. And I'm sure you are.
I feel like that's a big part of my life, is just trying to welcome people into our homes and create this experience with them where we share several days doing this ancient craft. And my wife feeds everyone like royalty, and we hang out by the fire at night and try to solve the greater mysteries, or just BS or laugh or like whatever. It doesn't always have to be deep conversations, but they're changing me as much as hopefully
You
the experience is changing them.
I
Because
am sure.
we love it. We get exposed to so many different people from so many different walks of life. And just the amount of advice and wisdom that you can gather from so many different people, if you
It's
actually sit
incredible.
down and listen to them speak, and you're in an intimate setting where there's only a couple of you and you're spending a few days together, yeah, I take away a lot of stuff. I take away a lot of lessons that I've applied to my business and my family, all from total strangers who show up
Total
here
strangers, yeah.
to build bows.
I know. We have the same experience they call when we run our hunting courses, when I
Yep.
do my survival courses, like these people change me just as much as I do them, and that's why I do it. It's a calling. I know that it's the path that's been created for me, and if I follow that, I'm going to find meaning and fulfillment for sure. And I know you're on that path too. I'm so happy.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
And it might
man.
not, it's not the path of runaway wealth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not the path of
No.
it is not the path of the undisciplined pursuit of more. Like,
Yeah.
it is it's an intentional life, and if you manage it properly, it's very doable.
Yeah.
We've got this idea, this freaking hustle culture, man, makes me sick.
Yeah.
It makes me
Yeah,
sick to my
same.
stomach, just this rat race. Like, how you been, man? Oh, busy. Busy,
Yeah,
like,
I
good,
know.
okay, good luck with that. Like, I do not want to be busy. You know what I
Yeah,
mean? I
I don't
want to
want to be
be
busy either, man. Jeez, it's hard though. I'm so busy. I've got to prioritize. I just have so many ambitions. I can't deal with them all.
I'm
But
exactly the same way, but if you just manage the time, if you carefully manage your time, you can do it. You can do
you can.
all of it. You really can. If you just manage it carefully, you can run all your courses. You can put out whatever product you're putting out. You guys can do your podcasts. You can meet these people, run your survival courses, and have a successful family. But it takes a lot of practice. I work on it every day. You can't zone out for hours and hours at a time, every single day, for weeks on end. Like, you've got to be intentional.
Yeah,
You're
you're
going to
right.
go to bed
Yeah.
tired, you know, then you're going to wake up early.
Well, let's talk a little bit about
You
that.
got it.
So I think that's where a lot of people might go wrong, man, because they're not having enough of that self-talk to get your ass up off the couch or whatever you're doing that you're locked into your stupid phone. Like, get up, put that thing somewhere where you can't get a hold of it. I told my wife the other day, I think I want to build a phone box where whenever you come in the house, your phone stays in the box. Like, don't screw with your phone again. And if it rings, get out of the house. You're not going to stay in the house. Go outside and talk. If you want to text, or even if you want to go scroll through Instagram or Facebook, get outside. Go outside. You're not allowed to be in the house.
That's very Amish of you.
Well, I'm just saying.
Very Amish.
I'm just saying the Amish have a practice where they put the phone in a booth in a little like basically port-a-john far away from the house. You have to walk outside of the house and go off into the yard somewhere to this little booth where the phone and the office exists. Oh, you cannot bring office work or phones into the home.
Well, I see it.
They're onto something.
I see it so much because we're not getting bored in stemming that creativity or that responsibility of things to do. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I'm saying this because I see it in myself sometimes too, because sure, we all get stuck into, you know, doing a little scrolling and stuff. And I'm like, oh, that's enough. My time's up. I'm done with it. It's time to move on and let's do something productive. And let's move forward in life and not just sit here.
The hard thing though, is that with work, like, you know, the phone is just, and social media is such a big part of it now that I think it really is trying to find that balance. But here's the thing, is that we talk about this negative aspect. We've just been talking before about this huge positive aspect, and you know, this spiritual side that we all possess is what helps us navigate all the bullshit, right? That's the strength behind it all. And you know, like, people are listening right now, and you know, we're a survival, hunting, and bushcraft podcast, right? Well, why the heck are we talking about mushrooms and everything? Well, because all of this stems from a connection with the natural world. No one is ever going to thrive in the outdoors if you walk out into it and you feel like a stranger. No, you're going to thrive if you walk out into it and it feels like you're in the house of God. You're in creation. You're in absolute bliss and beauty. And you know that your body responds in the way of just complete like joy and blissfulness of being out in it. So it is important. It's an important thing behind all of this, is to have that connection. And you know, so Corey, like, I want to get into some of the skills here. You know, your connection is very much through archery, and I mean all three of ours is, but your connection with crafting these wonderful tools, which, you know, I love the way that you share it all on Instagram, and you use that platform in a really positive way, especially those short videos of you shooting your bow. I love that. Love it. And before you get into bow building, I got to ask, man, so with your shooting, let's talk shooting. Were you inspired a lot by Fred Aspel with your shooting?
Fred Aspel is definitely someone I look up to. He definitely took camouflage out of my life, for example. Gave me some practical stalking advice. I really like his book. I believe it's called Stalking and Still Hunting. Is that correct?
Phenomenal book.
Oh man, my hunting changed when I switched to flannel shirts. I couldn't believe it. I think the synthetic materials have an energy. I'm just saying, it's not natural. It's not natural. And the animals can sense that. I don't know if they can see it through like UV light or what, but I just have this sneaking suspicion that it doesn't matter how much money you spend on camouflage. It doesn't matter if it's a tech suit with a battery in it that puts off an electromagnetic field or whatever you're spending your money on. Not calling anybody out. I'm just saying, I think the artificial materials don't help. That's just my personal experience. As soon as I switched to flannel, deer hunting immediately went up a notch.
You're kidding me. So you had a tangible difference.
Oh, noticeable. Yeah, I started putting way more deer down on the ground when I switched to a fuzzy cotton flannel that diffuses light. And I took that from Fred Aspel. So now I only hunt in naturals, really soft, fuzzy cotton, a lot like this flannel I'm wearing now, or
wool.
Wool. Yeah. Yep. And I don't know. I think I take a shooting inspiration from a lot of different styles. Like I can hold a fistful of arrows in my bow hand with the points facing up. That's a Comanche style of archery.
Comanche, yep.
I have a pretty significant forward lean. I see that in the Hadza, for example.
Yeah,
I
big time.
think Brad also talked about leaning forward into the shot to get better sight alignment. I do agree with that. So I take inspiration from a lot of different places, but Fred Asbel was high up there for hunting for sure.
Yeah, I agree with you. He's very inspirational. Taking it back to the bare essentials. And this is something I'd love us to kind of what something that I'd love to point out is that this art of hunting is ingrained in us. But the way you do it, making all of your own equipment, is really the magic, because you're using those two sacred hands, like you mentioned, that you've been given to create these tools, which without those tools, we would never be here. Our human race would not, we wouldn't be here. And so you're recreating that, and then you're going out into the woods and you're having this amazing experience where you feed yourself using the tools that you made. And I know that that must just feel wonderful. The shooting aspect, though, of a primitive bow takes a lot of hours, and it looks like you shoot just about every day.
Pretty close, yeah. I try to do at least half an hour every day,
Every day.
but sometimes if I catch a break, I'm out there. You know,
Yeah.
if I reach a natural stopping point in the middle of the day for work, I'll
Yeah.
go hit my workout on the pull-up bars and shoot a couple rounds of archery. So I'm always trying to sneak it in. If my wife is, you know, in the house getting ready to put my son down, I'm sneak out, get my bow
Yeah.
out, shoot a few, maybe two dozen arrows real quick.
Yeah.
So yeah, I try to just freshen up on it often.
And you're shooting completely instinctual, right? For the listeners, meaning you don't have any reference really. Well, maybe you do subconsciously referencing your arrow tip, but for the most part, you are completely focused on the spot that you want the arrow to hit. Or are you kind of a split vision shooter? How?
Okay, so the form people to tear me up online, first of all, because my form is abysmal. I lean forward, I have a really sloppy release,
Doesn't matter, you're consistent.
exactly. I really encourage people, and this is what we teach in our workshops, because I teach, for example, in bow making 101 at the end, the last afternoon for like 4 or 5 hours is intro to longbow marksmanship. And then we do one-on-one coaching during our advanced class for like really getting fine-tuned with these weapons. But I tell them find what's comfortable because that's the most important thing. For us to be using these cookie cutter approaches, which is fine to get somebody started. I do agree that form plays a role. You know, anybody can go out and whack a golf ball, but if you want to be a serious golfer, you need to have some form. It's the same with archery, but you don't have to have any specific form. It just has to be repeatable. And so I tell people like find a way that's comfortable. You might be a 6 foot tall guy with a 22 inch draw. If that's how you shoot, just accept it. There's no masculinity attached to a 27, 28 inch draw. You know, just it's putting the arrows on target. So find what works for you and stick with it for a really long time. Like people get so, they get in the weeds on the internet is what happens. And there's always going to be people out there and bless them. It's good for the community, but who are going to break down the science to an exhausting degree. I've listened to some people talk about archery form and within like 15 minutes, I'm lost in the sauce. I have no idea what they're talking about. Talking about shifting body weight from 30% to this foot to 70% to that foot to 5 degree rotation of the hips right before you do this and that. I'm just making this up here, but you get what I'm saying. Some people break it down to an absolutely exhausting degree and it's really overwhelming. So I just tell people find what's comfortable and stick with it forever. Because if you, not forever, but stick with it for a good long time before you decide if it's working for you. Because if you're out there switching up your shot cycle every time you go out, you're going to be a mess. You're never going to find that missing link. You know, shoot for a couple months and then change. Change up something about your release. See, okay, did that improve my accuracy? If it does no effect, go right back to doing what's comfortable. We're changing, it's like an elimination diet. We're changing
It
one
really is.
factor at a time to figure out what causes an allergic reaction. And I do the same thing with archery. But I would say overall, my personal technique probably looks crazy, but what's happening inside my head, mostly instinctual. But I admit that it's some type of split vision shooting because I have the arrow shaft in my subconscious always. I try to tell people when you're first learning, let's get you shooting, let's get you shooting a beach ball size group at 20 yards. This is progress here. Really, it's not even about the groups. Or it's not about precision. It's about repeatability. So, like for example, I want them to be stacking arrows in a nice tight circle, no matter where that is on the target. That's goal number one. Precision comes with time. So accuracy is being able to put those arrows in the same spot over and over, and then you figure out where your bow shoots or how it shoots. I'm thinking about the flight path of the arrow. And so I can see in my peripheral vision, the sort of yaw of the arrow and, the tilt. And I know the flight path of my bows because I shoot them every day. So if I grab, say, a 55-pound bow off the rack, I know what that flight path of that arrow is going to look like from, say, 18, 20, 25, and 30 yards.
And you don't know that in specific, like, inches or anything. It's just a subconscious knowing, correct?
It's
Like
a
a
subconscious aiming, yeah, because I
aiming.
can, I'm staring with all my might, all my focus on that little tiny spot that I want to hit. But right there in my peripheral, as I'm drawing and everything, I'm kind of pre-aiming because I can see the arrow shaft coming back to my eye and I can predict its, cant and everything.
Sure.
And then it's just, yeah, watching it soar to the target, kind of like visualization, because I'm visualizing the flight path of the arrow through my peripheral vision while I'm staring at the spot. But that's really all I think about. And the arrow's subconscious. The main focus is the spot, and my release is god awful. So it's
Yes.
definitely not about the follow through.
Dude, my release, that is the one thing I have to constantly work on. I don't know why I've always got this habit of plucking away from my face instead of coming directly back. It's just something my body wants to do.
Yeah, mine's very exaggerated. I throw my hand away. I
Oh,
like I
you throw
whip,
your.
I whip it back. Because I read this ancient text, I believe it might have been Arab archery, very old text written in like, I don't know, the 1500s or 1300s or something, like medieval times. And the Arab archers were some of the most feared warriors of all with the bow and arrow. And they talked about a violent and qu a quick and violent release of the arrow is what builds all the power from the bow. And it also is supposed to affect arrow spine as well. They thought that if you had a proper violent release, arrow spine would not matter. You'd be able to pick up your enemy's arrows totally unknown in
Interesting.
dynamics and shoot them back at them accurately. So I practiced just throwing that hand away like really exact in a really exaggerated way. But that helps to keep you from plucking out. If you just think like rip it through and throw it away.
I've noticed it doesn't affect the accuracy too much, but it certainly affects penetration and arrow flight when you don't have that clean release.
Yeah, for sure.
And that penetration is just so crucial with a primitive or traditional bow because we don't have a lot of speed. We're really relying on that sort of momentum of the arrow to do its job. But if the arrow is not flying perfectly, we will not get that penetration that we really need.
Yeah.
So building a bow, could you, without exhausting detail, give us a step-by-step process of what building a bow for you looks like from cutting down the tree to testing out the bow, shooting the arrows.
Okay, Cliff Notes version.
Cliff Notes version.
Okay. First, you need to know a little bit of tree ID because you need to be able to identify hardwoods or semi-hardwoods in your area. It's very region specific. You might have maple. We don't have any maple other than silver maple, which is useless, but let's not get into the weeds. But we have all the oaks, hickories, hackberries, like we have all that stuff here. Walnut, Osage orange grows like weed around here. So many, many different bow species here. But you need to be able to identify them. Some of them are easy, but say you have your, just pick your core five. Pick five hardwood trees and learn how to identify them. Next, you're looking for 6 feet of uninterrupted trunk. The lower trunk makes the best bows. You can use branches and you can use saplings, but they come with their own challenges. As you know, because I believe the Hadza use very small diameter sapling. Like,
yeah,
don't they end up with almost a completely round cross section?
It's completely round. The whole bow is round. Yeah. And they never use anything more than a couple inches diameter. Yeah.
Yeah. That takes some serious skill. So I advise people away from tiny little saplings at first. What the golden tree is basically about four, no smaller than four, no larger than 8 inches in diameter. Because once you start getting above 8 inches, they can be a little bit dangerous. You know, you need to have some tree felling knowledge. Otherwise, you can become injured or killed by a larger tree very quickly. So say to a 4 to an 8 inch tree, you can just take a silky saw out there and harvest your bow wood. You don't need the saws and the chainsaws and the wedges and the equipment. So 4 to 8 inches of lower 6 feet of the trunk, as clean and straight as possible. So no branches, if possible. You can navigate around a few. You're going to cut it down. Make sure you coppice the stump. That's very important. People get really bent out of shape about cutting down trees right these days, but it's also because they don't understand sustainable forestry techniques. If you coppice a stump, like for example, I just cleared out a whole bunch of these invasive honeysuckles that live next to our garden, and they grow very rapidly. They were shading the garden. I cut them, coppice the stumps. 2 weeks later, they've got shoots coming out like crazy.
Yeah.
If you don't kill the root system, the tree will recover. So just coppice the stump, which means cutting it at an angle, a clean cut at an angle, so that water does not pool on the top. That tree will live. You'll come back in 2 years and it'll have sprouts coming out of it. You'll come back in 10 years and it'll have little trees coming out of it. And in 50 years, you won't even be able to tell that there was ever a tree that was cut there. It'll just look like one stump with a bunch of full-size trees coming out of it.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So just take care of your stumps and you don't have to worry about cutting down these small trees. And I'm trying not to get into the weeds here, but also it's worth noting that these smaller immature trees are not really going to affect the ecosystem that much. In fact, a lot of times I just call them suckers because they are coming out from under very large mature trees and they're competing for the canopy. And so they shoot up really quickly and they get all tangled up in these big mature trees and they just take nutrients and water from the tree. And they help to, you know, blind the understory so that some of the other native grasses and things can't thrive. So don't feel so bad about cutting these tiny little trees out of the understory. Then you got to split it out. Depending on the size of the tree, you either split it into quarters or you split it into eighths. Usually I recommend quarters because if you get greedy with your staves, usually you just end up with firewood. And then you have a couple different options. You got to get them dry. The long haul, which is as a professional bowyer, there's a lot of long haul work because I have a revolving door of trees coming in and I don't want to process them all. So strip the bark, seal the ends, and let it sit for at least 1 year, preferably 2 years.
Seal the ends with wax?
House paint, shellac, anything that you have. Anything to keep moisture from escaping, polyurethane. Okay. You name it. You probably have something in your garage that can seal the end of the stave. So get the ends sealed, store it for 1 to 2 years. Or you can reduce it slightly. I call it a reduced stave, where while the wood is green and you freshly processed it, you strip off the bark and you reduce the stave to, say, 2 to 3 inches wide by about 2 inches thick. That one is going to be ready in 6 months to a year max. And then you can also further reduce it to a bow blank, and that will be ready in a few weeks. But you do need to strap a bow blank to a board to keep it from warping.
From warping, okay.
Yep, because it will warp wildly if you don't.
And are you just storing that under the normal atmospheric conditions? I mean, obviously you don't want them in sun, but are you concerned about humidity or?
Normal conditions. And obviously if it's the middle of summertime and it's very humid, you're going to have a lot of issues with getting them dry, but it all equals out.
Okay.
You can also speed dry it, like over a fire, for example. A fantastic bow can be made in as little as a few hours from a green live tree. But I always tell people, the further you speed this up past the bow blank form, that's when you're going to start running into issues of the wood ripping itself apart, like drying checks and things. So try not to get in too much of a hurry, because bow making is not an impatient man's hobby. So you can rough it out to a bow blank, let it sit for 1 week or so to equalize, and then you can throw it in a hot car in the summertime and let it sit in there for 3 or 4 days, and it's ready. It's totally dry. So you're just forcing out that last bit of moisture. But you need to give it like 1 to 2 weeks in the open air to season. And then there are ways, of course, to speed it up, but I don't advocate for them. Not until you're experienced a little bit. So then you take away everything that's not a bow, make it look like a bow-shaped stick. There are many, many different designs out there from all different regions of the world. You've got everything from Neolithic flat bows that are 10,000 years old and 2 inches wide, to the English longbow, for example, that is, 7 feet tall and 1.25 inches wide. So you have all different types of shapes and sizes. Just do your research on the style that you want. Books are very helpful. A lot of great books out there on the craft. Make it look like a bow. And then you're going to start slowly removing wood until it bends a little bit. And so you do that through the floor tillering process, which basically means you just push it against the floor, slowly removing even amounts of wood until you get some flex. And from there, things slow down a lot.
Could you talk to chasing the growth ring quickly?
Yeah, that's species dependent, and also time of the year dependent, because if you cut, for example, what is known in bow earring as a white wood down in the summertime. So a hickory, hackberry, elm, like any of these sort of broadleaf hardwood trees, you can take the bark and just peel it right off. And you'll have a pristine, untouched back ready to go. The back is the part that faces away from the archer. So the back of the bow must be pristine, no matter how you achieve that. The first is a summer cut tree, strip the bark, ready to go. Super easy. Problem with a summer cut tree is a lot of excess moisture. So you can cut them in the winter when the sap is down and significantly speed the drying process. But then you have to take the bark off with tools because it's very tightly adhered to the wood. So you strip the bark, and most times you will damage a growth ring, and that's when you have to chase it. And so a tree's rings are made up of early wood and late wood. The early wood is what the trees are putting down right now, where the foliage is popping out nice and full for the first time. They're growing super fast to get all their leaves and everything. That's putting down the porous, spongy early wood. And then once the trees are in full, fully leafed out and taking in lots of summer sun, they start putting down late wood, which is the dense, hard wood. And so we're going to get a tool, usually a draw knife, under the layers and peel it off so that you get one continuously exposed late wood ring. And it's hard to describe in a podcast, but it's a very clear difference. As you're working through the rings, I mean, one of them is very crunchy and porous, and stringy looking. And then once you get down to the late wood, it's very hard and waxy and polished looking. And
And you're
so.
and tool wise, you're doing you're starting the process of reducing your st so you've just pulled your stave out of storage and you've got it ready to start reducing, and you're going to use a draw knife, right, to do that.
Right. Yep. I mean, any number of tools. Like, for example, on my YouTube channel, I have a video called Making a Bow Without Special Tools or something like that. And I show you how to do the entire process, which is a hatchet and a knife. So you can go as minimalistic as you want. But I will say that a hatchet and a knife build will definitely make a man appreciate a draw knife and a rasp. So if I could, if I could recommend two additional tools besides your hatchet and a knife, you're going to want a good draw knife and a good rasp. So, yep, most of the shaping is done draw knife and rasp. And most of the tillering, in my case, is done with a rasp as well. Although a lot of people advocate for tillering with a card scraper.
So I actually really like the card scraper. You don't really use it though?
I like it in certain cases. It really depends on what wood I'm using. If it's a wood with that has very pronounced early wood to late wood separation, it creates these huge step downs in the growth rings, and it makes it really difficult to tiller. So in that case, I will use a rasp because the rasp will keep everything nice and flat. So if you're struggling with bad washboarding or with bad ring separation, ring step downs, Just switch to a fine tooth rasp and tiller with that.
That makes a lot of sense. So for the listeners that are sort of not well versed with some of the terminology here, something I kind of want to stick on for just a few seconds or a few minutes is tillering. So tillering is the process of basically just thinning out or whittling down the limbs of the bow so that when you actually draw the bow back, the bow is going to flex to the sort of dimensions that you want, right? And this is really going to go hand in hand with two things, right, Corey? It's like depends on the poundage of the bow that you want, as well as obviously having an even tiller, right? So both limbs bending evenly in symmetrically, I think would probably be the right way to put it, correct?
Yes, evenly and symmetrically. The first priority is to get the limbs bending symmetrically and then evenly and symmetrically, and then you focus on weight reduction. Because normally in the early in the process, the bow is going to be extremely heavy. And so the process is difficult in the beginning because of how heavy the weapon is. But once you achieve an even bend, then you know that the bow is stressed well, and you can continue with removing weight, trying to get a bowstring on it, things like that. The
Yeah, and I
early
feel like,
stages of, oh, go ahead.
well, I just feel like, so I would just, for me personally, that the tillering is the real art of bow building. I don't know how, if you would agree with that, but I feel like it doesn't take a extraordinary amount of skill, especially if you're not chasing a growth ring, to get to the point where you can shape something that kind of looks like a bow, but to really have that symmetrical tiller of both limbs, I feel like is something you just, there's no fast forward button on that one. You just got to put in the time and feel it through and eventually build up the experience. Would you agree with that?
The tillering is the entire, it's all the meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
If you can figure out a good grasp on the tillering process, you can make a bow out of almost any stick out
Yeah.
there.
Yeah.
But without it, if you don't have a good grasp on it, or at least some practice under your belt, you can take the most pristine stave and just screw it all up beyond repair.
Yeah.
So that's where boards come in. If people want to learn, a great way to start is with dimensional lumber, because it's not quite as arduous as like a stave build from a tree. There are many hardwood boards from the hardware store, like hickory, red oak, maple, that will make a serviceable bow that will shoot just as well as a bow made from stave. Because at the end of the day, a board is just a tree that's been sawn into a square. So that's a great place to start, especially to iron out all the early tillering bugaboos, I guess.
So
I think there's, yeah, go for
I
it,
want
Corey.
to go back real quick, and we were talking about the wood, and I'm only used to working with Osage Orange, Corey. I've made a couple of self bows, and you talk about that stair stepping whenever you're using like one of the card scrapers. I was curious, is there a wood, if somebody's going to start, with a stave and they're new at this, is there a wood that you would point somebody to that's easy to be able to identify that pithy early wood and the late wood, and it still be somewhat easy for them to work? Because I know like Osage is, I mean, that's a pretty tough wood. If you're going to chase a ring on freaking Osage, it's work, is there a
100%.
better Is there a better wood, or is there, or what's your favorite, and what would you point a new person to if they were looking into building their own bow?
I would have different recommendations based on someone's region, but around here and in a very large portion of the United States, sort of in this whole central region, there's going to be hackberry, which is like a medium density hardwood. It's very similar to elm in that it's very stringy, very durable. We teach all of our bow making 101 classes on hackberry wood because it works excellently under tools. Because hickory wood, for example, is very commonly recommended as a beginner wood because it's so resistant to breaking. You can make some really serious mistakes with hickory and still get a serviceable bow. But the problem is it's as hard as it's like working a solid piece of steel under tools when it's properly seasoned. So it's very difficult to work. But hackberry is nice and soft, soft-ish. It gives under the tools. And you can still make some mistakes because it has interlocking grain, much like elm. So it's very hard to break.
And let's talk to that mistakes. So what would be the common mistakes that someone needs to be aware of to where they could possibly rectify the mistake and how, or be able to identify that there is no point in continuing and they should just throw that stave away and start again?
Number one problem I see online on the forums, I don't really post on the forums that often, but I do patrol them, I guess, kind of in the shadows, just to see what people are up to. And one of the most common mistakes I see is people want the bows to be way too short. You're really handicapping yourself by making the bows too short. And it's not that they can't be short. You know, I, for example, I've made many Native American reproductions that are in the 40s inches, like 4 feet in length. The only thing is people don't realize that a short bow must have a modified draw to say 21 or 22 inches. Yes. And so people want really short bows that they can draw all the way back to the corner of the mouth. And so I see so many broken bows online from people going too short. Mm-hmm. I would say you can rectify that by just make the bow as tall as you are. Just get a few. Yep. They're just called man-tall longbows or archer-tall longbows. Make yourself a couple archer-tall longbows and you'll have some room for error. Yes. As you gain experience with tillering mostly, you can start creeping the lengths in to, you know, you can reduce an archer tall longbow by up to like 20%. It'd probably still take it to full draw. So make them a little longer.
If you're working the back of the bow and you notice there is a knot, like just a knot that goes right through the stave, so from the front to the back, is that something to be concerned about with all woods or certain woods? Or, you know, and then if you could talk to maybe like how you could work around that if you really wanted to give it a go, like backing the bow.
Okay. Knots are going to be a bigger deal with certain species than others. Like, for example, you could violate a knot. It's called violating the knot when you cut off the top, because knots will swell the grain and push it out. And so I tell people there's a volcano under there. When you're looking at the top of the stave and you see a little knot, what you don't see is this little volcano of wood that comes up around the knot.
Yeah.
Like a cone. And so you need to, when you're working your growth ring, you leave a small island of wood around the knots. And then you come back later with a very fine tool, like your pocket knife, or I use a Swiss gouge often, which is just a more precise carving tool. And you sneak up on that knot, being mindful that there's a volcano under there where the grain is swelling. So as long as the knot is carefully worked, you can get it down to a single growth ring, knots included, and have a durable bow that will never have any issues. But like hickory and hackberry, for example, you could technically cut right through them. I don't advise it, because even with the strongest woods, a violation of the grain will always be a weak area. And I don't really want to purposely create a weak link in my bow. But let's say you have one that's just riddled with knots. Very common with Osage. Osage is known for having many little pin knots and things around it. I'm sure everyone has a tree in their region that's similar. Elm is often very knotty. Walnut is very much the same. So you would work those knots the best you can. And then for a little bit of assurance, you can back the bow with something. Most commonly would be linen or rawhide. Like you can just go get high quality linen fabric from a fabric store or online.
Interesting.
Linen.
I don't know why I haven't heard that before. Linen, really?
Yeah, like something like, I don't know, $30 worth of linen will back many, many bows. So
stretch it over there. And are you backing it? So if you're not using like a rawhide glue, can you use just a regular wood glue? What do you recommend for backing?
Yeah, just regular old, readily available tight bond free is kind of the golden standard for bow making. because it's waterproof and it's a PVA glue that is food safe and non-toxic, so you can apply it with your bare hands and it's safe.
That's
So I
awesome, man.
recommend
Yeah,
Type R3.
that's really cool. Yeah, because linen, I mean, we can get, anyone can get that anywhere, tight bond, any hardware store, and that's a really good way of recovering from maybe building your first bow and then being sort of under pound. Like, if it's a little bit light and you want to stiffen up a little bit, the backing could add a few pounds, right? I mean, is there a sort of a number on you can place on whether you back a bow and how much more poundage you can get out of it, or is it sort of dependent on a lot of factors?
Something like linen probably will not raise the draw weight.
Okay.
Another very common backing is rawhide. Goat rawhide makes excellent backings, like the stuff they sell for drum making. It's paper thin. I use whitetail deer rawhide that I process from the deer that I kill myself. That makes a good backing. The deer rawhide is going to be a little bit thicker, and so you might notice a few pounds of gain, but if you really want to get the draw weight up, you're going to be looking into something more like sinew backing, which, yeah, will take some skill and a lot of time because sinew is best applied with authentic hide glue. You can do waterproof, modern glues, but it never really allows the sinew to dry properly. So the problem with sinew backing makes a fantastic bow, makes it very durable. It adds probably 10 to 20% to the draw weight, but it takes like 2 months to dry conservatively.
And just to back up a little bit for the listeners that are a little bit lost on this, we're talking about, so as Corey said earlier, the back of the bow is the bow that faces forward, faces away from you. That's the part that is we're talking about covering basically with the material to protect it, to add some strength. And in case you do have a little splinter or a knot, it would just help keep the whole bow together. Because every time, so let me get this right. When a bow, the way that the wood works is when you draw that bow back, the back of the bow, I mean the part of it furthest away from you, is under tension, and then compression would be experienced on
The belly.
the belly of the bow, right? Did I get that right, or did I mix it up?
Nope, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so the fibers on the back are being pulled apart under tension, and it's a very impressive amount of force. I believe several thousand pounds is being put on those wood fibers as they're trying to be ripped apart. And then compression on the belly side as the
And
wood
the
fibers are
compression.
being, bent into one another.
I think that's really
Sorry.
important to know. Just the basics of like the fundamental basics of how wood does what it does when you pull that bow back and release it. And then, of course, all of that energy that's transferred through the string, through the into the arrow. And that's why you should never dry fire a bow, right? If you dry fire a bow, that energy doesn't go anywhere other than staying in that bow. So the worst thing you could do, potentially break the bow, is dry fire it. So you always want to shoot a bow with an you always want to shoot an arrow when you shoot a bow. Never without any arrow attached to the string.
Absolutely.
Man, so then, okay, so you've got your bow made. You've got it tillered, you've backed it, maybe you haven't backed it, but you've got this awesome bow. You then it's time to put a string on it, right? So are you pretty much using synthetic sinew for your strings and then making your own strings, I imagine?
Yeah, I make all the strings from scratch, but I do use modern bowstring materials. The reason being, I've done many natural string materials. I've used rawhide, sinew, plant fibers. The only thing is, I would never want to sell one with those type of strings because they're more susceptible to moisture. They can break over time. I really just don't want people to worry about the string. There's always a psychological factor with a natural string where every time you pull it back, you're kind of like, is this the time? Is this the time it's going to snap and catch me?
At the end of the day, you're running a business and you've got to worry about people's safety, so.
And the string is the weak link. So I just use modern bowstring materials. And they're totally waterproof. They last, I don't know, a million arrows before they ever even begin to degrade. A lot of times the bowstring will outlast the bow, or you know, easily a single bowstring can last as long as the bow if it's well maintained. I don't feel great about the forever chemicals that are in that, you know, these like high density polyethylenes and things. But I figure it's one bowstring that's going to be with that bow for its entire life. It's a worthwhile sacrifice to me.
Yeah,
I would agree for sure. I mean, I've used, paracord, sinew, rawhide, and I you just can't really argue with the modern day bowstring.
And they don't stretch.
It's night and day difference.
They don't stretch much either. I mean, so you're not having to, adapt with your knock or any of that stuff with the, I don't mind it because I can drag it through everything and it withholds. I beat the crap out of my bows.
Dude, I love talking about bows.
Yeah.
I want the string to be durable.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely agreed.
Joel, are you...
You know what, man?
I know we're getting close to the end, but I wanted to... Man, I just feel like this would be an amazing whitetail camp if we joined Keith in here on this deal. I think we should look at putting something together for Oklahoma in November if you're open to it. I think we should set up a little deer camp, dude. I don't know if Joel's going to be able to make it or not, but we need to plan some sort of a hunt or something.
It's on my calendar, man. I'm really, really planning on doing that hunt.
Yeah.
Corey, man, like it would be so good to hunt with you and get together again in the woods.
Yeah. I would love to get together with you guys for a whitetail camp. I'm down to travel. Also, we have fantastic whitetail hunting up here. In the public land, they're pushed
hard.
Dude,
I want to apologize to you because I feel like such a douche whenever I came out there that time. I got so excited whenever we saw that buck, and I just like threw you the camera. It was like, dude, do you mind if you film this? And afterwards, I've literally thought about that since the day I left there. I was like, what a douchebag move to just do that. But I had so much fun with you hunting, getting permission from that guy on the private property. That was so fun.
Yeah.
He spotted us.
The only reason we even got permission is because he was a fan of the Alone Show.
For real. For real. But that was a legit hunt, and I would love to have you come out and hunt. I feel like I owe you a rattle in, so you can see what it's like to have one come barreling in on you. Both of y'all, really. And Keith, I put Keith in front of several deer, and he didn't like any of them.
We'll get Keith in the podcast and talk whitetail here in a bit. But congrats, man, because I know last season you took a beautiful buck with your self-made bow, and that's a wonderful achievement.
Yeah, that was the buck of my lifetime. He's hanging up on the wall over here. But what a cool experience. Right in the peak of the rut. Bucks and does all over. There had to have been, I don't even know. This was in that property where the deer are. Yeah. We talked right before we went on the air where the deer were so thick.
Yeah.
You just can't hardly make a move without blowing it because there's so many eyes and noses on you.
Yeah.
But just deer everywhere. I had perfect wind. Good sized bucks all over. I would have been happy to take any one of the bucks. And it was getting sketchy because there were so many deer so close to me. And I was in the perfect little spot. I was in a fallen tree, like just a few feet off the ground with great cover in all directions so they couldn't see me. And it was getting sketchy because they were all like chasing each other around, all around me. And I was waiting it out for this big buck who was making his way toward me really, really slowly in the slow marsh. And he was the slowest moving of all and the most vigilant of all. And it took hours. I watched him just running around for probably 2 or 3 hours at the end of the evening, chasing each other. And then right at dark, he walked right under my tree.
Sweet.
18-yard shot, beautiful angle because it wasn't too high up.
Yeah.
So it's a slightly above broadside shot and perfect double lung. He didn't even know what happened. Arrow struck him, went through both sides. And he just looked around like, what the heck was that? And then he walked off with the arrow. He just like walked really slowly out into the open with the arrow sticking out both sides and just fell over right there in front of a tree.
That's
awesome.
He had
no idea he was even hit. He was he was trying to lean over to continue grazing. And
I mean, if you look at the spectrum of how prey animals die, you know, like up here being eaten alive by a wolf versus being shot by Corey's arrow, thinking like what's going on, and then trying to eat some grass and tipping over and die. Like, it's a pretty damn good way for that animal to pass.
Oh, yeah. It looked to me like he thought, well, did I just get stung by a bee or what just happened? Yeah. Like, he didn't jump or anything. He just looked around and carried on with his life and fell over. Had no idea.
That's awesome.
It feels so good when you when an animal can die in that way. Just, you know, just quick, you know, and then it's easy recovery. You know?
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, he was down. It was easy recovery, but unfortunately, he was down in this really deep marshy valley. The water was like up to my mid shins, and it was steep hills on both sides, and I was a long way from the truck, and it was a brutal extraction.
I'm yeah. like, you trying. Earned it.
I was gassed by the end of that thing. By the time I got into the truck,
they don't. Well, my friend,
they don't get big by being stupid.
Experiences and shooting bucks and building bows and. All of this has just been wonderful, man. I cannot thank you enough for coming on and really just expressing a bit of your vulnerability and sharing your experiences. I got a lot out of it personally. Yeah. So thank you for that.
Yeah,
it's been so great to talk to you guys.
Yeah, so appreciate it, Corey. We definitely need to stay in touch more. I want to keep this brotherhood going and building on this. And, your message is so great, man. I took away a whole bunch off of this podcast, and I'm probably going to have to go back and re-listen to it, because I'm sure there's stuff that I probably missed.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And, Corey, I know that you've got, you're running a bow building, course up in, with Kai up in Alaska, up in Canada. Talk a little bit to that, and then also just any anything you want to mention, how people can find you, what you offer, just go ahead.
Yeah.
So the bow making class in Canada is happening. We've been sold out for our course here in Nebraska since early in the year, so we don't have any more openings here in my shop. Okay. But there are a couple opportunities coming up. There is the Canadian experience with Kai and Dave Maroney. Up at Lure of the North. That's a remote wilderness base camp up in Ontario, where we're going to do a 6-day deep dive and build the bow, quivers, and arrows. And then you'll also have the option to extend your stay to get some tips from Kai before you head out on a 2-day self-guided small game hunt with your new archery equipment.
Oh man, that's the way to do it right there. Oh dude, I want to go so bad.
Me too.
So they'll just have base camp. They'll just have base camp set up as their spot there where you're building the equipment. And then, you'll leave every day at the end if you want to and head out and try to test your luck on some small game.
Guys, I cannot recommend this enough. If this is at all calling out to you, let me tell you, you will not be disappointed because Kai and Dave are incredible people. The amount of experience they have up in that neck of the woods is unparalleled. And the chance to build the type and quality of bow that you get to do with Corey and then go hunt with it. This is a once in a lifetime experience.
Yeah. It's also, it's worth mentioning. I don't even know if there will be a spot left by the time this goes live. The booking has been open for 2 weeks and we're down to the last spot.
Okay.
Yeah. If you hear this, there's only 10 spots total. If you hear this, and that spot's still open, don't wait, because they're going pretty fast. But there's one more opportunity also in Kansas this summer. I've teamed up with a ranch called the Buffalo Nickel Lodge, and it's a 5-star wilderness academy. So it's that experience is going to be our bow making 101 curriculum. So it's 3 days. But the Buffalo Nickel Lodge has thrown in 5-star lodging, three upscale meals every day cooked by their in-house wilderness chefs. They've got an extensive new 3D course on the ranch, as well as a fully stocked open bar. So it's more of like a premier experience, higher ticket item, but all inclusive for that one. And there's still a few spots available. So if that's your style, definitely look into the Buffalo Nickel Lodge, and you can find all of this stuff on my website, which is organicarchery.com. There's a workshops tab there, and it lists everything that we have available. But aside from our regular schedule, the Buffalo Nickel Lodge in July, and Kai and Dave's Lure of the North experience in September, the last week in September, that's it for this year. And then we'll run a full spread next year as
Sure.
well, if all goes well.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad it's doing well, man. And I encourage everyone to follow you on Instagram, also Organic Archer. That's your videos and instruction on there is really valuable.
Yeah, organic period archer on Instagram. And I've also started a YouTube channel, which I've been putting a lot of effort into.
Oh, fantastic.
So,
Yeah.
yep, I'm going to get some of the more of the information out. So the YouTube channel is a mix of just ASMR style therapeutic builds,
Sure.
where it's just me building and you can see bows made from start to finish. And then there's also practical instructions, pro tips, stuff like that, and start to finish builds.
Yeah.
So if you want to see some footage of the process or even some step-by-step tutorials, I'm Organic Archery on YouTube as well.
Sweet.
Lovely. Well, fellas, let's call it.
Yeah, this is it. This is a
Everyone, thank you for
great
listening.
episode. Yeah, if you guys are still hanging in here, please go wherever you follow us. If you're not following us, make sure you do. Give Corey a follow, and leave us a 5-star review, you guys. It means so much. We are brand new in this podcast algorithm, and we want you guys to push us to the top, which is where we want to be. So much appreciate it, man. I love this so much, Joel. It is just, it's like every week, dude, whenever we get somebody badass like Corey and all of our guests that we've had, it really solidifies, I think, what we're doing and how we're doing this. Dude, we can't go wrong, I feel like.
It certainly feels like we're doing what we should be doing, and it's a lot of fun. And we get to learn too, and it's all just so good. So thank you,
Yeah.
everyone. We appreciate you. We love you, and go out and get in the bush.
Yep. Peace.
Ukuwa maukwa ishi.